Dawn of War 4 approaches, and the campaign follows on from the original game's expansion, Ad Cronus. The devs have taken huge inspiration from the original game, with a fundamental rework of the combat system and animations at a deep level. And as we have just learned, the Dark Angels are going to be a core part of the campaign, including the Lion. A big thanks to PlayOn for sponsoring this video. Dawn of War 4 is coming in 2026, so please help support the channel and click the link directly below to learn more. We were born to kill, not to build. We are not idle long enough to leave monuments. We leave no work of the enemy intact to spawn legends. We are the First Legion, and he that follows in our wake is death. One of the greatest challenges in discussing any of the Astartes, loyalist or traitor, is that disparity which exists between their foundational form during the Crusade and Heresy and that which they take some 10,000 years later in the Age of the Imperium and Era Indomitus. For the first of their kind, this divide is especially significant, for while in many ways they remained true to the core of their inception, in others they were damaged and broken, some might say beyond all reason. In the dark shroud from which humanity emerged at the end of the Age of Strife, thousands had died within the hidden underground facilities of the Emperor. All but a few remained nameless, anonymous blank vessels of human physiology, subjects to be tested, refined, and discarded as necessary. The genetic experimentation that would develop the Space Marines was never refined, beautiful, or artisan in its methodology. It was brutal, devoid of morality, and plainly horrific. Before their scattering, the Primarchs had from them blood extracted that would become the seed of genetic material needed to form the genesis of the Astartes. Some of the early proto-Astartes who were developed became harvesting bodies for that gene seed, and these were figures somewhere between Primarch and Astartes. Those that lived beyond the period of genetic development remained within the Imperial Palace until their demise, so secretive and important were they. Some were even seen, though, to participate in the final Siege of Terror and the palace itself. They wore armour of unadorned grey marines with no apparent loyalty to any singular legion or primarch, only the Emperor and Imperium. The First Legion were one of the Emperor's earliest experimental prototypes for the Astartes. They emerged in the final years of the Unification Wars and were deployed in campaigns that required a level of precision and discipline that their predecessors, the Thunder Warriors, simply could not bring to bear. Not least the crushing of an attempted coup at the gates to the Imperial Palace, which included remnants of their number and various techno-barbarian hordes. It was a last-ditch effort against this new order of human civilization that was always going to be doomed to fail. Their efforts were more symbolic than anything else. So the brutal deployment of the newly minted Astartes against such a disparate ragtag horde was perhaps too fitting for those such as Valdor to resist. As always, I want to delve into more than just the plain constituent principles of the Dark Angels, but sometimes it remains very often best practice to understand at face value what you're speaking about when it comes to 40k. The Ultramarines, the Wordbearers, Iron Hands, no matter who you speak about, superficial aesthetic and demeanour does not always relay the core intent of an identity. The Ultramarines, for example, despite being a highly default presence, I have heard all too often how people find them difficult to place or understand in the sense of their goals, their underlying principles within the Imperium and the wider galaxy, whereas others like the World Eaters or the Black Templars feel much more straightforward for the most part. You can kind of tell what their whole deal is straight away. And as I've noted before, the Ultras from my perspective have always been about holding firm the stability of the Imperium. They position themselves as that stalwart base for other legions to look to, an underappreciated yet essential role, made all the more difficult by that unwashable guilt felt from their absence at the critical period during the heresy. They seek to right this by making their presence felt through unbreakable discipline and guiding example. The first founding legions have always been more straightforward in some ways than those who were their successors. There were those who concerned themselves with crushing any who attracted the Emperor's wrath and would enforce compliance by any means necessary, such as the Space Wolves. And then there were those others who took on the role of protectors, like the Imperial Fists and the Salamanders. So then, what of the first? The Dark Angels stand apart among the Emperor's Astartes in the contemporary era as much as they did in the Unification and Crusade, but not because of any earned or implied sense of superior grandeur and glory. To me, what sets them apart is this palpable sense of dread that surrounds them, and it's one that comes from themselves and their history as much as it might the sense of impending destruction felt by any who are deemed a threat or liability to be eradicated. Then there are those to which they share a perhaps unwelcome bond, one that was never sought nor sanctioned, but exists nonetheless. For despite their stark differences, the Blood Angels share much with their brothers of the First Legion. The two, when they were legions but also chapters, have been known as the Angels of Death for good reason. That being, each harbours their own dark secret that they seek to keep from being known more broadly among the Astartes and wider Imperium by any means, including lethal discretion. As the first of the Emperor's legions to be deployed, the first were approved to wield many pre-heresy prototype systems of wargear, including plasma weaponry, mechanized assets, and Terran pattern relics. Such benefits may simply have come to them due to their proximity with him, and that resultantly, the Emperor trusted them to operate some of this more volatile technology than that which would be more broadly issued to later legions. No matter the reason, though, it marked them as a force known for its terrifying and unrelenting supremacy from the outset, bolstered only further by their legion's tactical doctrine, something that when taken in its totality would define them for the coming 10,000 years. Wargear alone, though, does not make a legion or a chapter. They are more deeply defined by those genetic traits inherited from the Primarch, forged by their chapter history and personally defining events, before being tempered in the environments of unending war and galactic domination, finally becoming slowly weathered through thousands of years of battle attrition that have defined the void of time between the heresy and contemporary Imperium. From their very inception, the sense of weight given to their purpose was clear. Those early Dark Angels bore no real identification markers and fought in terrifying silence. They were not just horrific and brutal in the methodical means by which they slaughtered their enemies, it was the very emergence of these Astartes who were simply monstrous to behold. These were not the human armies that had been recovered from the ashes of Terra, nor the barbarian technogenetic abhorrents who had bludgeoned the dying vestiges of humanity into submission. They were not the elevated minds of mortal humans who had survived in sheltered conclaves to become the new artisans of Imperial civilization, the painstakingly recovered builders of worlds. They were not even the custodial lawgivers, his arbiters of Imperial decree. The First Legion, the Dark Angels, were the blazing sword of the Emperor. They were judgment and condemnation made flesh, and for any who were unfortunate enough to encounter them, a final reckoning with fate itself. For the First Legion are killers in the purest form, those who seek no merit, only service. In the earliest days, they fought not as a coherent army, but as smaller hosts within the Emperor's force. Their genetic stock drawn from Terra itself, like so many of the legions. These hosts often originated from specific regions upon Terra during the unification time. Their specific battle tactics and methods forged them into these first hosts, which would then be later refined by their Primarch into the various wings of the Dark Angels. Those of the first may have been Angels of Darkness, but theirs was not one of corruption, as would prove entirely too popular among those consumed by treachery much later. Theirs was a world of shadow, but not subterfuge, for such things could be left to those among the 20th. The Dark Angels operated as the aspect of the Emperor which passes judgment without explanation, and most importantly, without witness. One might think such a role falls to the Custodes, and that may have been true before the existence of the First, as the Thunder Warriors themselves discovered. Yet some accounts persist of warriors clad in singular dark colours at that same location and time. It's a deeply clouded moment in Imperial history, and likely the truth of the matter can never be known. Yet what seems more certain is that the early members of the Dark Angels were used to hunt down and exterminate surviving pockets of Thunder Warriors or lone survivors in the years that followed. In some sense, the Dark Angels took on such grim responsibilities that might easily have been afforded to the likes of the Space Wolves, for they were the public executioners. Those of the First had to use a little more tact and caution. They were often forced to exist in the shadow, because the First represents the Emperor's hidden will. They were, in the most simple terms, enforcers. In this early time, the First were among those who were most trusted by the Emperor, and for that reason, given any tools necessary to complete an assigned task, without any hesitation, question, or acclaim, something their Primarch would still espouse 10,000 years later, saying, "Gather the redeemed and make ready for battle, my sons. We go to do the Emperor's work, not for glory or for vengeance, but because loyalty is its own reward." Lionel Johnson was discovered fairly late into the Crusade upon the world of Caliban, 11th in order of Primarch discovery, and nearly 60 years after the Crusade had begun. Like many of the Primarchs, adapting to a new life as a master of an Astartes legion was not easy nor comfortable. Having lived in isolation for so long, a master hunter and figure of decisive action, debate nor excessive calculations were one of his particular strong suits. They are reserved more for the likes of somebody like Dorne or Gilliman. The world of Caliban shaped not only the Lion, but those who would follow him upon the Great Crusade. For their home planet was a forest death world, choked with twisting, claustrophobic dark forests that sheltered horrifying, warp-tainted monsters. The infant Primarch had somehow survived alone and learned to stalk, strike, and vanish like a predator. He became an almost mythical figure, seen occasionally by the human inhabitants of Caliban, who perceived him more like a spirit of the forest. So when a contingent of the knightly order that existed upon Caliban finally found him, initially he was such a monstrous figure they mistook him for one of those they hunted with such regularity. Yet one among them, Luther, saw the figure before them for what he was: a huge, blood-soaked, feral human, wounded with damage that could easily have killed an ordinary man. He would name him the Lion. At first it had been little more than a humorous observation. This beast-like human with its mane of blonde matted hair seemed fitting in that moment. Yet as he demonstrated to his men and lifted that mane of hair, this was no beast, but a human boy. Still, the name stuck, and Luther saw fit to raise him within the fortress monastery upon Caliban. That Lion became Lion L. Johnson, Son of the Forest. As did all the Primarchs, it became readily apparent that there was more to this individual than they realised. The Lion learned with terrifying speed, but likely due to his early isolation, still remained distant. It would be a trait that would come to define his character, and as did all Primarchs, he excelled at enacting campaigns and strategic executions, in short order, entirely eclipsing his foster father, Luther. Together they launched a planet-wide campaign to purge Caliban of its great beasts. For 10 brutal years they hunted the monsters to extinction, overturning feudal traditions, drafting commoners, burning forests, besieging rival knightly orders, and crushing any who resisted. The scale of their victory left them effectively ruling the planet, and as the Lion inevitably ascended to become Grand Master of their order, Luther was quietly pushed into the shadow. When the Emperor's Great Crusade finally reached Caliban, he recognized his lost son with ease, immediately offering him command of the First Legion. Caliban itself was entirely turned over to Imperial rule and consequently became a center for industry. It was a jarring change, and one which perhaps inevitably did not sit well with all. The planet was effectively surrendered to industry, and what inflamed the situation was the lack of empathy demonstrated by the Lion, who had also proceeded to dissolve those old orders of Caliban. His knights, who were of age, many were converted to Space Marines. Those among the older members of his entourage, including Luther, were surgically enhanced rather than becoming full Astartes, which was fairly typical at this period in time. But of course, inevitably another example now of a wedge that could form a permanent divide between those clear-minded Terran veterans and those of Caliban. The first Dark Angels to serve alongside their Primarch became known as the 500, an honorary company within the Legion. Their task? To study the Primarch, to record what they learned and keep those findings hidden for the Legion's own benefit. None of the existing doctrines had prepared them for a figure such as the Lion, so they were required to analyze how he fought, which weapons suited his style, and how the Legion could adapt to match his methodology. The Lion himself offered no guidance, allowing his Legion to prove itself without instruction. They served still as his close guard, shadowing him, and they would create the Lion Codex. This would become one of the most secure and secretive texts in the Legion, for it contained their full understanding of the Primarch's strategies. Only the 500 may access or add to it, and they accept no replacements, for the knowledge will end with them. As the Great Crusade progressed, the Lion understandably earned a reputation as one of the Imperium's finest commanders. He was a master strategist, but also merciless. Still pragmatic. But he was cold, he was secretive. He was far colder than the likes of Sanguinius, Horus, and Gilliman, never really able to appeal to the masses. For he, like his Legion, were all about decisive actions, not diplomacy. But as Primarch of the First Legion, and with the Dark Angels having held that long original connection closely to the Emperor, when Horus was made War Master, unlike some of the other Primarchs who thought they were never in contention, or those who thought they may have been like Sanguinius, the Lion took the ultimate decision far more personally. He never really was able to overcome the slight upon his character, whereas others simply understood that the Emperor made the best decision and they would learn to accept this. And I think this, alongside perhaps one of his other greatest failings with the Lion, came in the form of his inability to see the more emotional nuance, some might call it, within humanity, including those who were very close to him. So that when early into them having joined the Crusade, the Primarch chose to send Luther, along with a small force of Dark Angels, back to Caliban, under orders to garrison the world and increase the speed and the quality of the training given to the Legion's recruits. This did not sit well with Luther. The key piece of information omitted here is that Luther had discovered whilst they were in the process of negotiating a compliance with a civilization known as the Soroshi, an atomic weapon had been brought aboard the Primarch ship, and upon discovering this, Luther chose to do nothing. He was observed as looking pale, but basically dismissed this out of hand. Later, he even would admit outright that he had considered allowing the Primarch to be consumed in atomic fire, that he desired the Legion for himself, Caliban, and most of all, resented being the most capable and powerful individual with his own lifetime, only to be eclipsed by one such as the Lion. It wasn't just a hesitation, Luther effectively confessed to treachery, but he did walk it back soon after. Nonetheless, And as was typical with the Lion, the theory and practicality of returning Luther to Caliban was sound, but it is also very unclear just how much he knew of what had been said by Luther. It may well be that in this moment he simply thought he had fallen short of his official duties and was generally not very happy with being in proximity to himself. And I think it's pretty clear that is the case, because otherwise he probably would have just killed Luther outright. But one might argue, at this point, Luther should have learned something from that situation. He could have sucked it up and just got the job done, proven his loyalty and worth to the Lion, and all would have been well. Unfortunately, this is not what happened, because Luther's resentment ran far deeper. And to go along with this, he was not the only one to be displeased. Many felt that the truth of the matter was that the Lion simply did not want them with him for the crusade, and that fact would continue to smoulder in his absence. Even for those who remained, the Lion was known for, after any significant campaign, barely giving any praise for those under his command. He would complete a task, on to the next one. And in some ways, that is how Astartes should be. In another way, they really enjoy the pomp and circumstance and the honorifics and the awards and the trophies. It's all part of the whole Astartes thing. Luther, though, continued to feel a sense of personal entitlement, and so when he would join Horus in a supporting campaign outside of the instructions given by the Lion, the revelation of this left him absolutely enraged. He ordered all ships to be stripped from Luther's command, essentially isolating and leaving Luther to languish on Caliban. However, the one saving grace for those who remained was that the many internal orders of the Dark Angels somewhat shielded them from the corrupting influence of the warrior lodges that were integral to corrupting other legions during the outbreak of the heresy. So while those on Caliban may have ultimately turned away from the Lion, they were not necessarily fully corrupted by chaos at this time. Now, the heresy itself is of course a vast topic, and to resolve the story of the Lion and Dark Angels for the purposes just today, all we need to really know is that, as we learned during our dive into Sanguinius's past, the Lion had met with Gilliman and the Blood Angels Primarch during this episode of Imperium Secundus. They were isolated from reaching Terra. They needed to formulate a plan. Their collective resolution was that Sanguinius would make for Terra itself, Gilliman, with his vast numbers in the Legion, would smash into any resistance because they anticipated such a move like at Beta Garmin. Meanwhile, the Lion would travel off to create distractions by raising the core worlds of traitor Primarchs. Yet his actions now were more out of really some sense of nihilistic spite almost than anything else. Upon the Raven Guard homeworld of Deliverance, he would meet with Korax and Russ, who would commit some of their forces to the Lion's cause of scouring traitor worlds. Eventually, the Lion did make for Terra, but as with Gilliman, he arrived entirely too late. Which then brings us to the quite abrupt end of the ancient story of the Lion. The Dark Angels did participate in the scouring, which of course suited them absolutely, rendering judgment upon traitors and wreaking a terrible vengeance in the aftermath of what had occurred was all about them. Yet ultimately, they would then divert to Caliban. Upon their return, the Lion very quickly learned of the corruption that had taken place there, as they were immediately under fire from ground-to-orbit weaponry. The Loyalists, of course, unleashed a counter-hellfire which systematically bombed Caliban. Those who survived took shelter in its fortress monastery, to where the Lion and Astartes would lead a surgical resolution force. Luther, though, was now empowered by chaos itself and would fight the Lion in a scaled-down version of the Emperor's battle against Horus. Once again mirroring that situation, the Lion hesitated, unable to complete the kill upon his friend and one-time father figure. Luther instead unleashed a psychic blast that mortally wounded the Lion, but in so doing realized his failure and despair. The expulsion of psychic energy somehow gave him a moment of clarity, so that now both men were on their knees, crying out in a state of terminal despair. The Chaos Gods knew they'd failed once again. The fallen traitor Dark Angels would be scattered from the world before the planet itself was destroyed by the unending orbital bombardment and the outbreak of a warp storm within it. But after his mortal wounding by Luther, the Lion would not perish. He would be transported to the centre of what remained of Caliban by those mysterious and diminutive Watchers in the Dark. They also would contain Luther in a secure stasis vault. Not even now the Supreme Grand Masters of the Chapter knew their Primarch lay within, and so for 10,000 years, Luther and the Lion remained entombed for all that was left of Caliban and the Dark Angels' new fortress monastery, the Rock. They would use this now as some sort of void home base, travelling around the galaxy, yet like so many events that came to pass, 10,000 years later, the disturbance caused by the Great Rift, the Cicatrix Maledictum, the Noctis Aeterna, seemingly impacted those within the Rock also. Luther was stolen away by a demon prince, and now little is known of his fate. Some presume that he still raises an army of the fallen, which seems very likely. The fate of the Lion also would soon begin to change. But in the aftermath of the heresy, that age of the Imperium began not with hope, but under a dark cloud of suspicion for so many. Doubt and mistrust were at true saturation levels throughout human civilization. The heresy had proved that even the Emperor's most trusted son could fall, and that revelation hollowed out the heart of the new Empire. The Dark Angels collected to mourn the loss of their Primarch, and they did so quietly, without spectacle. They folded their grief inward, as they had been trained to fold every dangerous truth. Together, they built a new, renewed sense of purpose, entirely fitting for the First Legion. Their masters crafted a plan, and in a sense at that time, they were reborn. Their armour also became that of the familiar green, in dedication to the forests of Caliban that no longer existed. But even in this rededication, the weight of what had happened there clung to them. They understood that zeal alone would not save them if the Imperium were to ever learn the full truth about the schism that tore their legion apart. The brothers who had strayed and the indelible stain of the ruinous powers. Thus, the Dark Angels convened a secret conclave, the first inner circle. For as they saw it, the truth had to be contained now, forever. They constructed also a labyrinthine structure of oversight, a network of watching and being watched. Every battle brother, officer, even the masters themselves would live under permanent scrutiny. Any sign of corruption, doubt, or forbidden knowledge could be hunted ruthlessly. Of course, the disaster on Caliban was just too vast to hide. Psychers across the Imperium had felt the psychic convulsion when the warp storm combined with the battering from the orbital vessels and destroyed the planet. Yet every survivor was bound by oaths so severe they bordered on psychic chains, never to speak of the betrayal, even as the traitor legions were withdrawing toward the Eye of Terror. But perhaps conveniently, in these times of utter confusion and total chaos, a homeworld lost to another act of cataclysmic destruction amid a warp storm was simply another entry in a long list of Imperial calamity. No one had time to really ask the questions that might have unravelled in the millennia that followed, and so the Dark Angels' carefully constructed veil remained intact. Caliban remained buried, and the Dark Angels were now tethered to this newfound sense of duty and determination to endure, serve, and reclaim what had been lost, namely, the Fallen. Also, their newly formed inner circle decreed that as long as even one of the Fallen still lived, unrepentant and at large, then the Dark Angels would now remain unforgiven. Their legion's shame would cling to them across the ages, and their duty to atone would have no end. From that vow sprang their mission that would shape every decision they made in the centuries ahead, for theirs was a hidden crusade. But it was also one which became their very primary driving force in the coming 10,000 years. Of course, despite their best efforts, the Dark Angels' shift towards secrecy did not go unnoticed. Their growing isolation drew the attention of many, especially in this new age where entire institutions such as the Inquisition were being created to root out internal residual corruption, so that after Caliban's destruction, formal inspections were all but inevitable. The verdict, though, was cautious but favourable. The Dark Angels were permitted to continue as a fighting force. Some leniency was granted in recognition of their losses. A Primarch had vanished, their homeworld was annihilated. Yet perhaps more simply put, the Imperium just still required the Dark Angels at that time. There was no outward or really internal signs of corruption to be seen, and they remained a coherent force which delivered results, and as such, they basically passed the test. Perhaps most interesting of all, though, was the fact that their traits of being generally quiet and internalized with their affairs meant that their withdrawal into themselves didn't really seem very alarming as it might otherwise have done. The First Legion of the Lion were expected to be dark, silent, and somewhat brooding, so although they had become even more cautious and reserved, it could all be explained quite rationally by those outside observers. The Dark Angels continued to prosecute the Imperium's wars with that same effective, cold precision they always had, and so in the centuries post-heresy, their records spoke louder than any rumours or questioning inquisitors who sought to make a name for themselves. And as one master would espouse, internalise the truths you have already learned, use them to fuel a penitent fire that will only be quenched by the waters of redemption. As was typical for all legions, the Lion, upon being given command of the First Legion, sought to restructure and refine its existing practices as he saw necessary. For most legions, this was always an uncomfortable process, but with their Primarch now leading them, most could get past the discomfort of having familiar battle doctrine and strategies reforged for the next phase of their crusade deployment. However, the Dark Angels had become absolute masters of combat through the use of their hosts. In its earliest era, the First Legion was a storm of experimentation, testing every form of warfare and tactical structure imaginable. It gathered specialists for every battlefield role, but lacked a really unified framework to bind them. They ended up in this state of being constantly shifting, discarding failed methodology. Sometimes their approach was messy, but only in the sense of them being an experimental prototype. Over time, this hardened into order, forming the specialized formations that became the core of the First Legion, enabling them to face any foe in any theater and prevail. They essentially evolved the ultimate fighting doctrine. It was composed primarily of two distinct bodies, the Great Hosts and the Orders of Battle. The Hosts were the larger of the two, with each individual force claiming the loyalty of hundreds of individual warriors. Hosts were dedicated to the perfection of one art of war, some specialized in siege warfare, others in the brutal discipline of shock assault. Controversially, they did not fight, though, as a cohesive formation in most situations. Hosts were spread across various chapters and companies of the Legion, so that then any given unit might comprise members from a variety of different hosts, all working together, lending their experience and skills to their battle brothers so that the whole had greater value than any individual. Even the smallest First Legion squads contained at least one specialist from a host, giving the Dark Angels a breadth of expertise that other legions may have lacked. Only in the most desperate battles may an entire host deploy as a singular body, and while generally a single squad could contain warriors from several hosts, bound by multiple different oaths and traditions, a Dark Angel answered both to his battlefield commander and his superiors within that host's secret society, navigating authority in these long ingrained customs. It was pretty complicated. Quite honestly, in these days, that such a system like this functioned at all, given how relatively confusing and diverse it was, speaks somewhat to the organizational discipline of the Legion, to just be able to understand what exactly they were doing. Then you have the orders of battle, and while broadly they were more varied, they also contained far fewer members than these hosts, with most counting no more than a few dozen initiates per order. They were not able to share their knowledge as broadly as did the hosts, pretty much for that reason, because those who belonged to the orders were experts in the singular aspects of war. They were the most refined specialists. The concept being that should the Legion encounter a foe who defied all sensibility, then usually the orders of battle were able to devise some kind of strategy that would disable an enemy advantage and lead an assault using their knowledge as a weapon against those greatest enemies of mankind. So that was the earliest somewhat chaotic formation of Dark Angels' organizational knowledge and strategy. But then later would come the far more epic sounding foundation known as the Hexagrammaton. The phrase itself was said to loosely translate as the Six Divine Ways, and this would be the title given to the Dark Angels' great hosts. It came into use throughout the Legion in late M30, when the Legion reached their nominal strength of 100,000 warriors. At this stage, having steadily refined and distilled their battle doctrines, many of the earlier battle hosts had, through processes of attrition, failure of their doctrines in battle, they generally had just withered and disappeared. Those who did remain were collectively regarded as the more pure expression of battle tactics forged by the First Legion. It was really a process of elimination, but those who remained were in fact so successful that when the Lion took command of the Legion, he would retain the Hexagrammaton virtually unchanged. The Primarch took steps only to reorganize their hierarchies to structure them more closely echoing the Calibanite cohorts with which he had conquered the dark forests of his adopted homeworld. Symbolically, they also changed the title of those forces to become Wings, to mark his ascension to the position of Grand Master. So this six substrata organization within the Legion, the Wings, the Hexagrammaton, would be so powerful that they remained unchanged until the end of the wars ushered in by the Horus Heresy. The widespread destruction wrought by that era, though, would see the annihilation of some of those bodies. So within the Hexagrammaton, you had the Stormwing, who provided the unbreakable infantry corps that mastered discipline, line combat, battlefield cohesion. By M41, this had been consolidated into the wider chapter structure, but the Wing as a distinct formation did not survive. Then you had the legendary Deathwing, who would become a permanent aspect of the Dark Angels. They supplied the Legion's elite shock troops and sworn protectors. They would shatter enemy formations with heavy Terminator armor units, and these became the first company as the Dark Angels were remade as part of the Codex chapters. The only other Wing from the Legion days to survive would be the Raven Wing. They also survive to M41, and they deliver the highly necessary flexibility via speed and precision in terms of skimmers, air units, etc. They now form the chapter's fast attack reconnaissance force, still specializing in pursuit, rapid strike, and of course, hunting the fallen. The other three who did not survive to the Age of the Imperium were firstly the Dreadwing. These embodied just annihilation through the use of wielding the forbidden weaponry and enacting extermination protocols with horrifying finality. Some say that this is partially returned with the Lion and the emergence of those known as the Risen, but in truth, it's really little more than a spiritual successor, because also many of the weapons and techniques used in the early days in the really horrific Dark Age of Technology weapons just do not exist now. There was also the Iron Wing, who brought overwhelming mechanized power to crush fortresses with their war engines and artillery. Again, this was not retained because I think once the Legions became a chapter, their smaller force was able to more readily and flexibly utilize this kind of hardware but at a broader level. They really just attach whatever armor or firepower was required into the general battle force, because chapters, they're kind of more multi-role, and while they have individual companies who are a bit more specialized, there is a lot of flexibility. And then similarly, and also last, you have the Firewing. They were the more unusual one because they acted as the so-called hidden blade, basically a stealth unit to destabilize enemy leadership through assassination, infiltration, tactical insights. Again, I think it disappeared for several reasons. One, just the practical application of how conflicts the chapter now found itself to be engaged in evolved over time. There was just less reason for a force like that. But also you have the more broad acceptance and emergence of Imperial assassins. So committing resources in a chapter is perhaps just less efficient overall when you've got something like the assassins available to you. Lastly, of course, you've also got the inner circle somewhat taking on that role, and therefore it just became redundant. In the era of the legions, though, these six wings allowed the Dark Angels to meet any threat, adapt to any war, and prosecute battle with a depth and versatility unmatched by really any other legion. Post-heresy, the unity within the Hex mattered more in the centuries which followed than perhaps anybody could have anticipated. The Dark Angels had to hunt their own without fracturing. They had to fight under constant scrutiny without showing any sign of deviation or division, and they had to maintain a shared identity while some of their brothers were out there among the stars being hunted down. The Hexagrammaton unintentionally became foundational to their own survival because it gave them a way to stay unified but also without sentiment or big public visibility in how they were doing that. Through their structure, practice, and the discipline of having a clearly delineated purpose, it really shaped and formed their direction, especially going forward to M41 in terms of hunting the fallen. I think in some ways I do liken this to the Eldar Aspect Warriors, with each representing this highly specialized path of war. But while the Hexagrammaton is a military framework where an individual Dark Angel may serve within one or more wing over their lifetime, and perhaps not so much in the chapter era, but with each existing to keep that legion adaptable, letting them meet any foe with the exact force that's required. Their organizational engines built to just strengthen the unified whole. Aspect Warrior shrines are comparable in some sense, but they're more spiritual disciplines, as each constitutes a rigid path that shapes the psyche of an Eldar, one so powerful that it risks even the emotional destruction of any should they stray out of its control. But I think where these ideas overlap is in the military doctrine. Each aspect within the Eldar focuses on one facet of their mythical god, Cain, being like vengeance, stealth, speed, flame. But just as the Dark Angels, the aspects enable the Eldar to deploy multi-role force that can handle a variety of different threats, and that diversity keeps them strong. At the deeper level, the aspects for the Eldar are about far more than just war, but in terms of how they're applied. They share a common similarity of binding identity, which overall makes their force hold together. In the 10,000 years since the Heresy, the Dark Angels' unified focus became their armor. Every wing drilled its role until it was near instinctual. There was never to be any opening given to an enemy, no chance of defeat. And in the earliest days of their legion, the dark weaponry from a forgotten age defined them. But now in the era Indomitus, their training, their extreme tactical discipline is who they are, because they are the ultimate weapons of the chapter. As the Imperium reached the era Indomitus, significant events, of course, occurred. With Rabute Gilliman already having returned to lead the Imperium and his crusade to secure the Dark Imperium, the Lion, holding something of a mirror to his past, would emerge from his slumber to find himself wandering the strange shadow realm that appeared entirely similar to the Caliban of old. This mirror realm is not well understood, but it may be something of a pocket dimension or shielded realm within the warp. I speculate that the Emperor created this realm for the Lion, as one of the only other inhabitants known to be there is an old, wounded king who cannot speak, and appears in different places, which seems at least superficially to be highly likely some projection of the Emperor himself. This mirror realm allows the lion to travel to different places and even bring others with him through an action known as Forest Walk. Eventually finding himself on the world of Kamarth, the lion liberated this from chaos and has slowly begun to create what is called his Protectorate. So far just a small collection of worlds within Imperium Nihilus under the protection of the lion and his loyalist forces. The lion himself retains no understanding of what allowed him to awaken, and speculation might again point toward an empowered emperor nudging a Primarch in a time of need back into reality. I would consider this again, not least because of the strange figure who inhabits the Forest Realm. Yet the lion in M41, much like Gilliman, is not the same figure who fought alongside his brother Primarchs to defy the traitors and bring stability and victory to the Imperium. The lion is now an unsettling figure, more brooding, contemplative than he ever was before. Whatever force has awakened him and enabled these Forest Walk abilities seems to have connected with him at the very center of his soul, which may also explain why he is able to enter that realm at will, passing into this mirror forest Caliban, traversing distances much as those who are able to utilize the webway would. Most curious of all is the concealed appearance of the lion. He is not chosen to become a strong, visible presence upon his return, as did Gilliman. He hasn't chosen to be a symbol of light and hope. If anything, he's remained at times in the shadow, even from those of his own lineage, remaining cloaked, observing without comment. He has not demonstrated any interest in joining the crusade of Rabute, and it may well be that this stems from that deep return to what he learned upon Caliban, to wait and observe, to survive in the dark. His legion learned early on that their Primarch understood silence more deeply than most understood speech. But upon returning to an Imperium, now partially consumed by darkness, the silence he finds is entirely different. It's not that quiet before the hunt. It's not the stillness of disciplined warriors waiting for command. It's the strained quiet of a civilization that has endured entirely too much for too long. It remains difficult to gather a true picture of the lion's understanding of the Imperium as things stand now, not least because truth is not singularly built from the observable or the documented in M41, as Gilliman himself discovered upon reviewing historical records of the 10,000 years post-heresy, before ultimately deciding that most were barely worth the paper they were written upon or the slates that had been encoded. The lion also appears to be now older in spirit, perhaps due to being at least removed from the immediate fury of betrayal. He sees how the disaster of Caliban was not just a simple act of craven treachery. In fact, that's something difficult to make stick when it comes to any of the heretic legions. So similarly, there's some nuance to those of the Fallen. Certainly, they were not unified in purpose. Many Dark Angels stationed on Caliban were caught in that same sense of confusion and divided loyalties that were so common in the heresy. Some believed the lion dead, others that were manipulated by Luther sought to survive the chaos ripping their homeworld apart. The dark decay of the Imperium is all apparent, and so for the lion, that civilization he served in the Great Crusade, which had demanded absolute clarity of action, no longer exists. The Imperium he has returned to has been worn down, twisted, manipulated by 10,000 years of power-mad conspirators, overzealous fanatics, treachery, well-intentioned collateral damage, and just broad confusion. And so in some sense we might consider, and perhaps does the lion, that the Fallen as they are, scattered, lost, ashamed, guilt-stricken, or otherwise defiant in their heresy, really exist as a microcosm of the reality that is now the Imperium. For just like them, it did not choose its fatal errors. Situations determined its slow demise through fear, isolation, and the collapse of order, just like the Fallen. Now, just before the interrogator chaplains drag me away, to be clear, this most certainly does not absolve those who are numbered among the fallen. Their repentance at this point would be near meaningless, and if anything, they fully understand that the Lion has never been a man of absolution. Until now. But I do think that it can to some extent reframe the situation, and in reframing, one might understand how an individual can become a traitor more often through abandonment and loss of direction than just twisted ambition. Anyway, I feel like I'm really not helping my case here, so probably best to just end this line of thinking. But it is true that the incredibly strict Lion of the Heresy era has shifted somewhat, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Regardless though, the Lion has made no secret for his contempt of the state of the Imperium's current condition, which is something shared by Gilliman. Gilliman feels very melancholic, even depressed about the state of the Imperium. The galaxy the Lion walks in is full of worlds which resemble Caliban at the moment of ultimate crisis. They're terrified, they're cut off, they're left to craft their own truth in the absence of anything else. The Fallen did not fracture just because they were uniquely weak. They fractured because they were all too human, and so many worlds of the Dark Imperium are far weaker than they. So entirely understandably, just as Gilliman, the Lion is far from pleased to learn of the Imperium that he has returned to, the disgusting corruption of humanity, the true nature of the Imperium with its bloated bureaucracy, superstitious religious machinations. It's all just entirely abhorrent to any Primarch. But the Primarch of the First would never have, in the past, had any patience for those who would seek power to elevate their own inflated sense of importance. He'd probably just execute them on the spot. And far less does he have any for those of the Imperial Creed and the Ecclesiarchy. Yet as similarly to Gilliman so far, he hasn't sought any aggression against these institutions, more something of a guarded arm's length approach. But where Rabute may seek to incorporate such things and make use of them, the Lion has chosen to ignore them entirely. The Imperium has endured not due to rigidity, but its all too human flexibility. Where necessary, it will make brutally stark decisions that cauterize corruption and any surrounding possible vessels that also may be contaminated. But at other times, there's room for interpretation, interrogation, even redemption. You see this among the Inquisition. Even those zealots of the Sororitas who lose their way are able to become repentia and return to the faith even more loyal should they survive, more respected by their sisters than they ever were before. They fell from his light, but had the strength and humility to bear their shortcomings openly, to correct them and return. So we may well imagine that one such as the Lion could find it near to impossible to forgive those of the Fallen for what happened. Rare is it that one who is subjected to the interrogator chaplains, for example, could be redeemed. But the Lion understands now that not all of them turned with intent. Some turned simply because nobody showed them the path back. A blight upon their character, certainly, yet we have learned that the Lion has been willing to grant pardon to the Fallen. Knight Captain Bors is one such example, a respected member of the 12th Company, but after enduring centuries of isolation and displacement, turned into a hardened pirate lord, commanding a fleet of Fallen and human raiders. What saved him was that while still a renegade, he never bent the knee to Chaos, striking against its forces still whenever he could. So when an astropathic signal claimed the Lion had returned on Avalos, Bors abandoned piracy immediately and drove his fleet straight into a Chaos warband, besieging the system. He asked for no pardon and offered no excuses, just his ships and his loyalty. The Lion, wary but willing to judge the man before him rather than the centuries behind him, accepted Bors into his ranks, and in that moment he became one of the Risen, and an example of how the pragmatic logic of the Heresy era was entirely at odds with the judgmental condemnation so typical in M41. The contrast between those two periods is more stark than we might imagine. Gilliman, for example, also appears often more human than so many of his own Astartes in M41. But it appears apparent that the Lion also recognizes that if he intends to guide humanity, he must reckon with the one truth the Great Crusade never had to grapple with before the heresy fell upon the Astartes. The result was that they never had to deal with this actual state of what the Imperium was intended to become. Now in M41, the Lion is realizing this is less of an appealing task than it might have theoretically seemed, which is also, I think, one of the reasons why it was hinted at and even spoken to by Malkador and the Emperor that the Astartes were not especially suited to the kind of more bureaucratic civilization world-building element which was to come after the Crusade. And as is so often the case, we learn more about this not necessarily from a novel or any cross-referenced quotations of heresy-era flashbacks or conferences. It comes from the Ox of Omen series, the campaign books. Bors has been practicing in the training hall of a Blood Angel's ship. The Lion and him are dueling with some others, before finally coming to discuss the current state of things. The Lion observes how a blight troubles his father's realm. Bors internally notes how the Lion seems to struggle, even speaking the term Imperium aloud. He often just says realm. Even then, despite his omission of the word, there still remained an edge of contempt in how the words of the Lion are being spoken. He recalls how the Lion even told him quite frankly that he's dismayed at the scale of the squalor, the ignorance, the fear that he's seen upon his return. But he also notes this is primarily reserved for those of status and power, the pompous adepts and priests. One of, and as I've said many times, the most awaited meetings continues to be that which is pending between the Lion and Gilliman, and for very good reason, because it may well become an era-defining moment. But the greater question perhaps is, will any other Primarchs re-emerge before this happens? It's difficult to discern just what the Lion's view of the current status for the Imperium is, most especially if he learns of how Gilliman has been somewhat collaborating with the Eldari and is meeting with whatever the Emperor is now. For the figure we know as the Lion, it could go in a variety of directions, from support to blazing wrath. So far though, the Lion of M41 seems very different than that of the Heresy era. He feels more patient, cautious, ready to look at the lay of the land and make an informed rather than instinctive decision. His formation of the Protectorate being one such example, a small-scale empire with what resources he has available now rather than launching an immediate crusade of scouring and revenge. Not least, he has stated his clear-minded perspective that even with so much time past, he retains that sense of duty and loyalty above all else. There may still be more to his realizations. On Caliban, the knightly orders preserved traditions that obscured the truth. When the Lion entered the picture, he stripped many of those customs away. But now he sees an Imperium where every system, military, political, spiritual, has retreated into ritual, into secrecy, into obfuscation. So perhaps we might say, the way that wounded beasts retreat into the shadow. The Lion's approach to things tends to be to strip all that away. The Lion had served the Emperor as a general, not a disciple. He knew the Emperor's work was intended to be rational, driven by unity and reason, secular purpose. Now, in the void that was left after the heresy, humanity filled that space with faith. But even within his own chapter, there is things which do not align. The Lion's ability to see and redeem some of the fallen stands at significant odds with those of the chapter, the Unforgiven. The Dark Angels spent 10,000 years slowly allowing themselves to be consumed by this sense of duty to root out, protect the great secret, at all costs, eliminate them. But within this, they also lost something very fundamental. The first were meant to be the Emperor's merciless blade, a force of precision and order. But now they're not defined by this. They're defined by their secrecy, their cold, outward hardness, much like a lot of the bureaucracy of the Imperium. So, in my opinion, The lion is seeing a lot of comparative similarity wherever he looks. His sons have become a chapter that's defined less by excellence and more by the weight of duty that they cannot speak aloud. They've carried around with them for entirely too long. And I think there's this sense that I'm sure he sees also expanded and projected into the wider Imperium, a civilization that hasn't resolved its overbearing guilt, its fragmentation. All is held together with ritual determination rather than broader, strategic, clear-minded comprehension. What awaits the Imperium, the Dark Angels, the Era Indomitus, is unknown, and that is very troubling. For while Gilliman is a rationalist and a reformer, pragmatic figure attempting to remake the Imperium into something functional and doing so very visibly, the Lion knows his brother well enough from the Heresy to understand just what that means. After all, he did break his sword. Gilliman is trying to make repairs to a structure that can no longer be fully rebuilt without making significant necessary demolitions. The only problem is, those which the Lion may seek to remove are also those which you could argue hold it all together. Load-bearing faith, let's say. Gilliman will seek unity and stability, order and legislation, delegated authority, most importantly, compromise. Gilliman is willing to compromise. He's willing to tolerate the religious fanatics. The Lion will most likely seek immediate action, a plan that achieves what he sees must be done, no matter the wake of devastation that may follow. For as was said, those of the first were born to kill, not to build, and what follows in their wake is death. Yet while the Lion and Gilliman may appear entirely incompatible, they have worked together in the past, they've made compromise, they've made strategic, sound agreements. The key is going to be how much restraint both can show, how much ability to see the strengths in one another they can have, and not just the weaknesses. It may well be that quite simply the Lion, as with his scouring of traitor worlds, sees fit to leave Gilliman to be the coordinator, the administration of everything, while he begins an unrelenting crusade of maximal, precise destruction, to finally put pressure on the great enemy where ordinarily they have always sought to put pressure to the Imperium. Now that's actually pretty simple, but quite honestly could be the best outcome. Gilliman can then continue to consolidate lost Imperial worlds, he can liberate, he can focus on his bureaucratic ability and planning, all things he excels at, while the Lion is left to focus on what he excels at, killing traitors. For myself, the return of the Lion and his role is entirely clear, even though we are yet to gain any significant update as to his actual forward progress. He's not here to restore the Imperium to what it once intended to be. Even he must realise that's a lost dream for the past. He's returned to keep what remains alive long enough for humanity to continue its fight. And again, perhaps who returned him is key, for it does seem speculatively likely that the Emperor, swollen with psychic power from the awakening occurring in humanity, empowered an easy victory through one of his Primarchs. He was always the Emperor's hunter, the blade in the dark, the one who dealt with enemies unseen and dangers unspoken. Now those dangers are so innumerable they can be found almost anywhere at any time throughout the whole Imperium. The Lion has returned, and the more he learns about the civilization of humanity, the greater his sense of understanding as to his own responsibilities and the duty of his chapter and its successors. He can see all too readily that the Imperium does not need some visionary leader. It has survived and endured for 10,000 years after all. Now what is required, more than anything, is a guardian, one who recognises that even while truth cannot survive for any significant length of time, let alone 10,000 years, clearly duty can. And while those among the unforgiven may have allowed said duties to consume them to a point of obsession, this is something he knows implicitly, that he was not returned to the Imperium just to see it restructured and painfully purged of those elements that are entirely incompatible with what it was meant to be, his duty now is surely to guide those who have had the strength and will to endure, even if they themselves cannot see the path ahead. The lion was born into a world of suffocating darkness and brutal horror, encroaching shadows that stalked you, and he knows all too well just how to walk that forest path that leads to death at every turn. The lion knows why humanity still needs him in this new age of darkness, even if for now he remains cautious and content to wait in the shadows. For when he finally emerges, the strength of his will and the reforged dark angels will surely be unstoppable.
For centuries we have been sworn to defend Kronos. We have returned to find a world in ruin. Hawk warlords infest the surface. Mechanicus priests pursue knowledge long forgotten. Ancient horrors awaken, claiming dominion over all. And something still stirs below. Buried deep, lost for eons, and never meant to return. We stand defiant. Kronos must not fall. And we are not alone. War has returned to Kronos.